Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Jupiter Oil Company versus Gene M. Snow.
May it please the court, my name is Joe Russell. I'm from San Antonio, Texas. I represent Jupiter Oil Company in this case. This case has to do with whether the intentions of the parties to a 1918 mineral deed will be effectuated by this court under the Four Corners Doctrine, or whether what's perceived as an artificial rule of construction under Alford versus Crum will cause this court to stop reading the deed after the first fraction. The first fraction in that deed is 1/16, and that seems to be the source of the problem.
Counsel, in order for your client to prevail, do we have to overrule Alford?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. My case is readily distinguishable from Alford versus Crum, but I do believe that that thinking is the source of the problem.
Could you explain?
Yes, Your Honor. The deed at bar is called the Henderson deed. It's a deed written in 1918 from Mr. Henderson to a Mr. Weaver. That deed says generally as follows. The grantee is to have 1/16 of the minerals. But because the minerals are currently under lease to States Oil Corporation, the grant is subject to that lease, but the grantee is to have 1/16 of the production, which is, the deed goes on to say, 1/2 of the royalty reserved by the grantor. And if that deed should terminate, then the grantee is to have 1/2 of the minerals. So the fact is that that old lease has terminated. That's in the stipulation, which was a handout to the court and is in the record, a 6-page stipulation of all the relevant facts in this case. That lease had terminated, and the question is whether the grantee interest is 1/2 of the minerals, or whether the court would stop reading the deed after the first expression of 1/16.
Is it your contention this deed grants two different estates?
No, Your Honor, because at the time the deed was given, the minerals were under a lease. The use and benefit of the minerals at that point in the hands of the grantor constituted only a right to receive the 1/8 royalty, and at the end of the lease to have the total reversion of the minerals. That's what the grantor had. Now, this grantor was operating under the premise that the effect of a lease is a conveyance of the minerals, a conveyance of a fee simple determinable in 7/8, leaving 1/8 fee simple owned by the grantor. Now, this is the analysis of the case of Tips versus Bodine, which is a Texarkana civil appeals case, writ refused outright by this court in 1936. That case is exactly on point, and the judge there said that the only right way for a grantor in this position to express himself and to part with 1/2 his minerals is first to say a present 1/16, which is 1/2 of the 1/8 that he then held, with a provision that the grantee have 1/2 of the royalty while the lease is going on, and after the lease expires, to have 1/2 of the minerals. Tips versus Bodine, writ refused by this court in 1936, is exactly on point here. And it would call for holding the petitioner has a 1/2 interest, just as the trial court found in this case. Now, the Court of Appeals felt, I believe, that petitioner truly has a 1/2 mineral interest, but that court felt compelled by Alford versus Crum, It's said that Alford versus Crum is a departure from prior settled law and that it must be followed, although the court doubted the wisdom of that rule.
So your contention is the subject to and future lease clause are not repugnant to the granting clause in this deed?
That's right, Your Honor.
So Coming, Alford is not implicated?
That's correct, Your Honor, because in Alford, the fact is that while the lease was ongoing, there was a lease in force at the time of that deed, and the grantor said that the grantee was only to get 1/16 of the royalty, but after the lease to have 1/2 of the minerals. So there was an interest shift in Alford. Now, I don't think that's necessarily a correct result. I think under the two grant theory, and particularly under the reasoning of Bingy versus Scharbauer, that two grants of this kind are permissible. I don't think there's any principle of Texas property law that would prevent that happening. But nevertheless, there is no interest shift in the case before us.
Well, but in this deed, it seems to me very clear that it conveys 1/16th interest. What could be clearer than that? I mean, your theory just has to say, well, that doesn't mean what it says.
Well, Your Honor, the case of Tips versus Bodine says that that's the only correct way. The judge in that case in 1936 says that that cannot be improved on as a way for a grantor intending to part with 1/2 what he had after he's made a lease and conveyed a fee simple determinable in 7/8. That was the reason at the time. The lease is a conveyance, fee simple determinable in 7/8, leaving fee simple in 1/8.
Just in the working interest, not in the...
Well, Your Honor, I think this does have a lot to do with the different ways that mineral interests have been looked at. Professor Summers in 1931 in the Texas Law Review said just that in Texas a lease is a conveyance except as to the 1/8. And
but
so...
If you knew that the grantor owned all the minerals under property, and if you knew that he gave a deed that said, I convey all that certain undivided 1/16th interest, wouldn't you, if that's all you knew, wouldn't you say he's conveyed 1/16th of the total interest in the fee of the minerals?
Yes, Your Honor, if there was no other language, certainly.
But to look at the other language to explain that just says, well, that sentence doesn't mean what it says.
It explains how it's written from a point of view, I believe, Your Honor. It's written from a point of view of somebody who felt like he only had 1/8.
From the point of view of somebody who's mistaken.
But I don't. There is some question in the commentary whether that truly is a mistake, because if in fact a lease is a fee simple determinable, and I think they still teach that in the law school, what is left? I don't think he owned all the minerals. I think that grantor owned something less than all the minerals. He thought he owned 1/8 and had granted, and that the 7/8 fee simple determinable, what we today call the working interest, was owned by his lessee, subject to a reversion at the time cessation of production.
That sounds a little far-fetched. Wouldn't that mean that the lessor could then release his 7/8 estate in the minerals?
Oh, no, Your Honor. The lessor has a fee simple determinable which reverts back to the grantor on cessation of production. In other words, the analysis is that an oil and gas lease is a conveyance fee simple determinable. I think that's still thought to be the rubric under which these are explained.
Now, are you familiar with our case of Luckel versus White?
Yes, Your Honor, I am.
Involves a similar question. In that case, a grant of a 32nd royalty interest. In that case, the habendum and warranty clause refers specifically to the 1/32nd. In this case, there is no specific reference of the habendum clause. It just says the above estate, the above premises.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does that make a difference?
Your Honor, I believe that in the deed at bar, all of the language constitutes the granting clause, it all precedes the habendum and the warranty clauses. And the habendum and warranty just refer to all the four, you know, the foregoing property. This is taken sentence by sentence because it is more complex than you can say in just one breath. Anytime you make a conveyance and you put a period, and then the next sentence is a reservation. Well, the reservation is inconsistent with the first sentence. You know, it's a deed should not be construed from just how much you can say in one breath. The whole instrument needs to be taken into account. And the expression of the 116, I think this case needs to be reviewed in its temporal context. This is a 1918 deed. In 1936, the Texarkana Court of Civil Appeals said there is no way to improve on that deed. You must start by saying 1/16 and then provide that the grantee gets 1/2 the royalty, which was 1/8, and then at expiration of the lease gets 1/2 of the minerals. You cannot improve on that deed is exactly what Judge Johnson said. This court refused the writ outright, giving it its highest award.
And that's the two estate or the multiple estate.
Your Honor, the judge there said that those weren't inconsistent, that that shows a consistent pattern of granting 1/2 the minerals in Pipps versus Bodine.
Counsel, if we disagree with you and find that there is an irreconcilable conflict, do you then propose we overrule Alford and adopt the Four Corners Rule and harmonize the conflicting provisions?
Yes, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals found that applying the Four Corners Rule would readily provide that there's a 1/2 interest in Jupiter and that there's, under the greatest estate to the grantee analysis, same result, 1/2 to Jupiter. Under the two grant analysis, in case there should be an interest shift, which is a shift in time, during the lease, if it's one interest, and after the lease. Now, this was the problem in Alford versus Crum. There definitely was a shift in the case of Alford versus Crum. If this court's not prepared to accept a two-grant analysis in the case of Alford, in the case of deeds of this kind, then the result of Alford versus Crum is not wrong. But it would be wrong as applied to this case. I'll yield to Mr. Kelton. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, I'm David Keltner, and together with Craig Price, represent the respondent in this case, Gene Snow. Your Honors, there are two issues in this case, one factual, one legal. The factual one, of course, is whether the Henderson deed granted a 1/16 or 1/2 mineral interest. I think the legal issue is, Judge Cornyn, and to the question you asked, is whether the court should abandon its decision in Alford versus Crum. Specifically stated, I think to rule against the respondent, the court will have to overrule Alford versus Crum, as the case is foursquare on point in this case. And in this regard, we have given you a handout as an exhibit that is also, by the way, Your Honor, page 11. Of our brief, and I have had it blown up for the court as well.
May I ask you a preliminary question, Mr. Keltner?
Yes, sir.
Can we take judicial notice that in 1918, the time this deed was written, that the standard royalty retained by the mineral owner was 1/8?
This court did that in Garrett versus Dills, Your Honor. I think that's a dangerous precedent, and I think it is for a number of reasons. If the court will do that, the court's going to have some problems after 1945 and 1950 era when a 1/8 royalty was an exception rather than the rule. And I would urge the court not to do that, but I must be honest with you and tell you there is certainly precedent for that point. Your Honors, very quickly, let me tell you, and again, I will refer to the handout that you have in front of you, and I'm afraid I have violated Justice Cook's one-inch rule on the blow-up, and I'm not sure you can read it from there. But let me just tell you, what we have done is put together a Henderson deed on the left and the Alford versus Crum deed on the right. And those are the three existing the three clauses, the granting clause up top, the existing lease clause, and the future lease clause. And I think the court should remember that the real holding in Alford versus Crum was that the future lease clause was different than the granting clause. And as a result, the granting clause controlled. In this case, the only difference the petitioner can come up with is that the existing lease clause is semi-consistent with the granting clause. But that's not the issue here. The one-half grant that the petitioner plays for is in the future lease clause. And there is no doubt, I think, that Alford versus Crum controls this case. And, Your Honors, one of the horrible things about this is Alford versus Crum is a decision of 7 years by this Supreme Court in 1984. There was a vigorous dissent that argued many of the things that the petitioner argues to you today. Some of those had been rejected in 1957 in Garrett versus Dills, the two-grant rule. The dissent there was also very vigorous, but rejected the two-grant rule. This court rejected it in 84. I will tell you that I think that Alford versus Crum is four square on this case, and to decide against the respondent, you will have to overrule it. And I think one of the things we need to visit about is, should the court overrule Alford versus Crum?
Are you familiar with a survey that was done by, reportedly from the opinions of the oil and gas lawyers, and Alford versus Crum was rated at the worst decision of the Texas Supreme Court in oil and gas?
Well, Your Honor, it wasn't quite that bad, but it was almost as close. And yes, I'm familiar with it. As you know, that is the subject of one of the footnotes in the Court of Appeals opinion. That was conducted, interestingly enough, by Mr. Hurd's partner. And, of course, he has the Luckel case in front of you and argued that very thing to you. Let me tell you that every decision that the court is looking at today was criticized when it came out. The two-grant theory actually started in 1925 in the Hoffman versus Magnolia case. That is the same decision that they would have you follow in Tips versus Bodine. It was heavily criticized. And even today in White and Sumner, it is absolutely clear that what the commentators say is the method of construction least likely to get to the grantor's intent is the two-grant rule. And in that respect, let me visit a little bit about Tips versus Bodine with you.
Well, counsel, the Alford rule doesn't even presume really to determine the grantor's intent, does it? I mean, the best thing you can say about it is it does establish a bright line, a simple test of determining what the grant in fact is.
Let me argue, if I might, for the Alford versus Crum rule for a brief second. In one respect, that's right. But let me tell you that Alford versus Crum reestablished and reiterated what the real theory in the case was and what we must look for, and that is the grantor's intent. But remember what intent that is, Your Honor. It is not what the parties may have intended but didn't say. It's what they said, and the intent flows from what they said, not what they meant to say. So I believe Alford versus Crum, contrary to the Eastland Court opinion, and I feel badly about criticizing the opinion in my favor, but we must do that in this case. I think Alford versus Crum clearly follows the Four Corners rule. But what it says is when you look at the four corners of the document and you determine that there is an irreconcilable conflict, you've got to resolve it somehow. And what you do is resolve it with the granting clause, because that is the primary cause. And primacy of clauses in Texas oil and gas law is not a new development. This court in Gulf versus Southland in 1972, held that the habendum clause controls over the force majeure clause when they conflict. And that is still, by the way, one of the largest cases ever tried, even in money situations, larger than Pennzoil Texaco, for example. Second case is Waters versus Ellis, which was decided 1 year after Garrett versus Dills, relied upon by the respondent. Also says when you have conflicting clauses and you look, you give controlling effect to the granting clause. I must confess with you, the Waters versus Ellis case is in neither of our briefs, and I apologize because, quite frankly, I simply missed it. It's 312 Southwest 2nd, 231. The passage I rely upon is in 234. Again, it was decided by the same court as Garrett versus Dills. And only one justice changed. Justice Greenhill replaced Brewster. Excuse me. Now let me get to Tips versus Bodine because I think that it is a case that the court should not apply. First off, Judge Eck asked this question, and Judge Heck, I think this is important. Tips versus Bodine does come down and is widely heralded by commentators as adopting the two-grant rule, a theory of what they had under an existing lease and then what later existed. There are several things about that case that are completely in opposite to what we're talking about here. That was a reformation case. And by the way, the petitioner has given you a handout with this case attached. Let me tell you that I think it's important for several reasons. First off, this case was tried to a jury, Tips versus Bodine. The issue was mutual mistake. And in fact, the interesting part about the case is the judgment of the court was to reform the deed, to provide what the plaintiffs had asked for. This is not a construction case as much as a reformation case. There was a whole body of evidence of what happened in that case, and the reason was that this deed was only 6 years old at the time the Court of Appeals decision came out, and both Ms. Tips and Ms. Bodine were still alive and testifying. Remember, this is a 1918 deed. There wasn't anybody available to testify, as most of the cases come up with conflicting clauses these days. The other thing that's interesting about that, I think, is that the two-grant rule doesn't work, and it never has worked well. It has not been applied. I think it was impliedly overruled by the Alford case. It has not been applied since that time. In Garrett versus Dills, decided in 1957, the court was asked, and in fact there's a vigorous dissent, talking about the two-grant rule, and the court didn't apply it. It is a dangerous rule, and let me just suggest again to you why Alford versus Crum cures that problem. The real truth of the matter is it ought to be certainty in law. There ought to be certain in land titles. Now, Texas has always gone its own path in this, but quite frankly, most of the country has followed, at least Texas oil and gas law, and wisely so. There ought to be some bright lines here. And again, I'm not suggesting that the intent of the parties be ignored, and I don't think Alford versus Crum does that. It asks you to try to find whether the intent from the document and what was said, not what maybe was said. The petitioner mentioned something that was very interesting, and he really is alluding to the Carruthers case. He said that is found in Tips versus Bodine that the petition or the grantor in this case was operating under the impression that they couldn't convey a mineral interest and only could convey parts of royalty. How do we know that? How do we know that that grantor was thinking that? It's impossible. The only evidence and the best evidence we have in these cases, and let me tell you, both parties have admitted, and you'll see in the Eastland Court of Appeals opinion, that this deed is not ambiguous. So the only
if
thing
it's
we
not
have,
ambiguous, how yes. can the subject to and future lease clause be repugnant to the grant? You have conflicting clauses there which need to be harmonized, don't you? Isn't that what ambiguity is?
In one respect, yes, in another, no, Your Honor, and I think that gets to the issue of the case. The real truth of the matter here is that ambiguity, whether there's ambiguous or not, doesn't really make any difference to the outcome. But the truth of the matter is, if there is an irreconcilable conflict, it has to be resolved. But the truth of the matter is, we know from Alford what an irreconcilable conflict is. And I think, Judge Eck, what you talked about in the habendum clause is very helpful. In Luckel, it was very clear that the habendum clause was tied to interests, to royalty interests. It is not true here. The habendum clause says that all grants are forever. There has to be a conflict here. And when there is a conflict, you look at what the party said, not what they may have thought, because we can't determine that. And then you make the decision.
So we don't seek the party's intent.
Yes, sir, I think you do. And I think Alford versus Crum says exactly that. It says it specifically.
Well, it says Alford says there's a controlling clause.
Yes, sir.
You don't look at the four corners. You look at the controlling clause if there's a conflict.
Let me beg to differ just only slightly. I think that the distinction is maybe finer cut than that. The initial look is at the four corners to see if there's a conflicting clause. How else would you know whether there was one? But if there is one, you don't think about what the parties might have thought and what was consistent and what was not. You look at the controlling language, which is always in the granting clause. Now, both in his brief and in the argument before you today, the petitioner has suggested to you that everything above the habendum clause is, in effect, the granting clause. I disagree with that wholeheartedly. The Court of Appeals in Eastland disagreed with that wholeheartedly. And also, let me tell you, this court has disagreed in both Alford and Garrett versus Dills, and has named these clauses very specifically. Now, finally, let me tell you one additional thing. In his brief, the petitioners allege that two other cases control this: Tips versus Bodine, to which I've already spoken, and Garrett versus Dills, which was argued in the Luckel case to you and has not been touched upon yet by the petitioner in argument. I think both cases are readily distinguishable, and I think by their very language they do not apply, because the court was looking at very different deeds. Let me give you an idea. In Tips versus Bodine, the case, remember, the petitioner said that you couldn't do any better in granting an interest. I disagree with a little bit with that characterization, although the court certainly said that that was that they didn't see any better way of doing it. The ending clause, there was an additional clause not mentioned here, and the Tips versus Bodine court called it the concluding clause or conclusion clause. And in that, Ms. Tips tried to reassert, or we don't know who drafted that. Well, we do in Tips versus Bodine. We don't know who drafted it. The grantor tried to explain again the character of state she had granted. And she went through it again, and she said that very specifically what it was, and it indicated that there was a different interest while the lease was in effect, and then one-half participation in all future events. And it was that clause, not in the Henderson deed, by the way. It was that clause, I think, that the Texarkana court relied upon and this court relied upon in refusing it. Similarly, in the Garrett case, and I am anticipating an argument on this, the clauses were again different. And in the future lease clause in Garrett, and remember in Garrett, 1/64th interest had been granted. And the issue before this court was, is that 1/64th royalty or is that 1/64th mineral interest? And what the court held is, the last clause again in the future lease clause, not in the Henderson deed, and interestingly not in the Alford deed either, was an explanation that what was granted was 1/8 of 1/8, which meant, of course, 1/64th, the same thing that was in the granting clause. That's not this case. This case is square under Alford versus Crump. Your Honors, in final conclusion, I tried to conclude twice, I guess, I must tell you that certainty must come to Texas land titles. We think Alford versus Crum gets it there. It's a criticized rule. So was Garrett versus Dill. So was Tips versus Bodine. So was Hoffman versus Magnolia. They all have been. The oil and gas bar in Texas is one of the finest bars that we have, and they're very active in writing. But I tell you, for the non-professionals or non-specialists, this bright line makes a lot of sense. It was a bright line that was relied upon in this case. If you change it, I will tell you I don't know, and the record certainly doesn't reflect, but I strongly suggest that there are thousands, if not many more, deeds drafted before 1925 when the two-grant rule was first adopted in Texas. And remember, this deed was written 7 years before that, so we can't assume they relied on that. There are literally thousands of deeds and abstracts that will have to be redone.
or will be time bombs in a chain of title if Alford v. Crum is changed. And I will tell you, to reverse this case, I think Alford v. Crum must be reversed as well. Thank you, Your Honors.
Any questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Counsel, how about beginning by addressing this time bomb argument that we just heard?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd like to. Mr. Keltner argues for trying to preserve 7 years' worth of history, and I would like this court to preserve 140 years of history from Hancock versus Butler. The Four Corners Doctrine has been the law in Texas since 1858. The Court of Appeals put it pretty squarely to this court. Is the Four Corners rule still the rule, the primary rule? Because that court said that very easily it would hold for petitioners if the Four Corners rule is the primary rule. But if Alford is a new bright line rule, then it would justify the way that the Court of Appeals came down. Now,
please respond to Judge Keltner's argument that really what you're looking for here is not what the grantor said in the deed and what his intent is as expressed in those words, but what we think he must have meant if he was writing that deed.
Well, Your Honor, exactly what the grantor said was that after termination of that old lease, the grantee has one half the minerals. So that's exactly what the grantor said in the Henderson deed.
So your view of Jupiter is, if we're going to go exactly by what the grantor said, there were two estates.
Well, I think that the grantee takes one half of the benefit throughout, consistently, throughout. From the date that deed was given to the end of time, the grantee has one half the benefit.
Well, you mean by benefits, you mean royalties.
Well, while the then existing lease was in force, it's the royalty. But after that lease dies, it's a mineral fee interest. An undivided one-half interest in the mineral fee simple is what this was. They call these future lease clauses. That's more appropriate for a royalty deed where I grant you a share of a royalty under an existing lease, and I say, I retain fee simple in the minerals, and if I ever make another lease, then you'll take a royalty share off that. I think these are probably inaccurately called future lease clauses. Other cases have called it a future interest clause. One thing that's never been an issue here is this never been confused as a royalty deed. This is a mineral deed of one half the minerals and taking one half of the royalty off the then existing lease. And at the conclusion of that lease, the grantee to have one half, if the whole deed is read, that just shines through without any question at all. Mr. Keltner talked about some extra words that went beyond that in the Tipps case. And the Tipps case is great reading, I think. I think it's a terrific opinion. I think the additional language was confusing. That's the additional language that was present in Tipps that's not present in the Henderson deed. The court said, well, this is a little bit confusing. This starts confusing us again. But they got over the confusion and resolved that case. Again, the facts and Tipps were these. I grant 1/16 of the minerals, grantee to have one half of the royalty. At termination of the lease, grantee to have an undivided one half of the minerals. That's exactly the same as in the case before us. What were the facts in Garrett versus Dills? The grantor said, grantee, I hereby grant 1/64 of the minerals, but it's subject to an existing lease, and the grantee is to have 1/8 of the 1/8 royalty while that lease is enforced. And at conclusion of that lease, now here's where Garrett got a little bit odd. It said the grantee to have 1/8 of the lease interests. And the court had to scratch its head and say, well, what does lease interest mean? And they concluded, and this is Judge Hickman's writing, they concluded that lease interest had to mean mineral fee. That's the only way they could make sense of it. But the court there said, after that old lease expired, but what the grantee had was 1/8 of the minerals, even though it started off saying, hereby grant 1/64 of the minerals. So Garrett versus Dills is very much in point.
I suppose if the property in this case is subsequently leased and a 1/10 royalty reserved, your position is going to be that you only have a 20th and not a 16th.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the grantee interest here is an undivided mineral fee interest, and so it's the grantee's job to either make a lease or not make a lease as the grantee chooses. It's not a part of the power of the grantor interest. This isn't one where it's a grant of mineral fee with executive right retained in the grantor. That didn't happen. The whole
you referred to benefit earlier.
Yes, Your Honor.
What I'm asking you is, if the benefit, that is the royalty,
yes, sir,
should at some future day be less than a 16th, you're going to say, yes, I'm only entitled to the less than, I'm not entitled to the full 16th.
Yes, sir. Yeah, simply a 1/2 mineral interest. If the standard royalty dropped to 1/100, then the interest of the grantee here is an undivided 1/2 interest in an 80-acre patch. And he would make a lease at 1/100th royalty and would be governed accordingly. This is not a royalty deed at all. And that's a lot of confusion in a lot of cases has been where people find it to their financial advantage to try to argue that a certain decimal is their royalty rather than a percentage undivided mineral fee. But this is not that case. This is clearly a mineral deed and has been treated as such from the beginning. So the question is, what did this grantor intend to do? And this grantor says it very clearly. He says it all on one page. That's the way, you know, we do deeds. And they go down in history in 1918, and it gets followed up in 1936. And the Texarkana Court of Appeals says that's just the way to do it. Mr. Keltner's right. That started as a Reformation case, and the judge couldn't believe it. He said, you can't improve on this. You've got to say 1/16th and 1/2 the royalty, and at the conclusion of the lease, 1/2 the minerals. That's the way you do it. Same was true in 1957, Garrett versus Dills. It was rolling on. History was rolling on. In 1981, when Mr. Snow took these leases, and I want this court to be very clear, it's stipulated that this interest was always treated as a 1/2 mineral interest. Stipulation, item 8, it's a 6-page stipulation, all the relevant facts in this case. Item 8 of that clearly says that this interest was treated as a 1/2 interest at all times. Paid bonus royalty, was paid to the wrong party. That's the reason we have to have a court case about it. It was erroneously paid to the wrong party. But it was always treated as a 1/2 mineral interest. And that's the way it was in 1981 and consistently through the time of this stipulation in 1988. And that's the way the case comes before this court. Everybody has treated this as a 1/2 interest. There's simply an error as to ownership. There does not need to be any judicial notice taken, by the way, of the fact that the old lease provided a 1/8 royalty because that is in the record. It is Stipulation Exhibit H, I believe, which is the old state's lease that shows that when Mr. Henderson made this deed, he had granted a lease with a 1/8 royalty, so that is in the record.
Any questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you,
Kevin. Thank you very much.
That concludes the submissions for the day. The foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will please adjourn.